From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Two big rulings from the Supreme Court today. We're going to get to both of them now. In one case, the court sided with the Trump administration and upheld a rule that could cut access to birth control under the Affordable Care Act. The vote was 7-2. NPR national correspondent Sarah McCammon joins us now with more on that. Sarah, this case had to do with the Affordable Care Act requirement that employers offer birth control coverage on insurance plans and who is exempt from that rule. Tell us more about the case and today's decision.
Yeah, and if this sounds familiar, Jeremy, it's because it is far from the first time that this issue has come up. So first of all, the Obama administration early on carved out an exemption for churches and synagogues who objected to contraception, to covering contraception on religious grounds. It's not the first time the Supreme Court has heard a challenge to this rule either. You may recall the Hobby Lobby case in 2014, for example, which was very high profile and carved out some exemptions for closely held companies. The Trump administration, though, went further and carved out more exemptions for more types of employers, essentially, saying that employers can raise religious or moral objections to covering contraception for their employees. That was challenged by the states of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, but the court has said today that the Trump administration does have this authority.
So do we know how many people it could affect and what the impact will be?
Well, the Trump administration, the federal government itself, has estimated that between 70,000 and 126,000 women could lose contraceptive coverage under this policy. And we also know more broadly that under the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, more than 61 million women have already gotten birth control coverage, just to kind of put it in perspective. And these would be people who work for places like universities with religious affiliations and perhaps other employers. This carves out reproductive rights advocates say this carves out a pretty broad exemption for employers who have a religious or moral concern about providing contraceptive coverage.
This was one of the big cases people were waiting on. What kind of reaction have you seen to the ruling so far?
Well, it's as you might expect. Religious groups, anti-abortion rights groups are praising this. They say it protects the conscience of religious business owners and organizations, protects their moral objections. Groups like the ACLU and Planned Parenthood, meanwhile, say it's an infringement on reproductive rights. It's an interference, they say, with women's ability to make personal decisions about their bodies.
That is NPR national correspondent Sarah McCammon. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in another win for religious liberty today, the Supreme Court ruled, also 7-2, that religious schools can largely hire and fire whom they please. That case centered on two former Catholic school teachers who had been fired, one because of her age, she claimed, the other because she had breast cancer at the time. Both tried to sue their schools for discrimination, but had their case rejected today by the high court. Tom Gelton is NPR's religion and belief correspondent. He joins us now. Tom, remind us what was at the heart of this case.
So this involved the circumstances under which religious institutions, churches or schools, can, as you say, can make their own hiring and firing decisions without regard to employment law, because employment law, you know, obviously gives certain employees protections. The court ruled 8 years ago that there is what is called a ministerial exception in employment law, meaning that religious institutions cannot be forced to employ ministers who don't abide by that institution's beliefs. Now, today's decision broadened that definition. In this case, the court said that those two teachers at parochial schools, even though they taught mostly non-religious subjects, could still be considered ministers because they performed at least some religious duties. So it really means that religious institutions are pretty much exempt from employment laws in pretty broad situations, Jeremy.
Because we just got this ruling a few weeks ago from the court saying that people couldn't be fired from their jobs based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Does that mean that in this case, at a religious school, they could still fire somebody based on that or based on race?
Well, not based on race, Jeremy. I mean, the courts have been really clear that there is no exception when it comes to discriminating against people on the basis of race. That's illegal. But yes, I think the fact that the court says that there is a ministerial exception would certainly seem to me to mean that religious institutions could say that they're not going to hire somebody on the basis of their sexual orientation, or let's say because they believe in same-sex marriage, because those would violate the school's religious beliefs. I would say this certainly would make it clear that schools, institutions would have that freedom, yes.
NPR religion and belief correspondent Tom Gelton, thank you.
You bet, Jeremy.
Well, today, President Trump tweeted out that he disagrees with the CDC on what he called their tough and expensive guidelines for opening schools. Shortly after, Vice President Mike Pence said at a task force briefing that the CDC will be issuing new guidelines on schools reopening next week. This comes as the U.S. saw another one-day record for new COVID-19 cases yesterday, 60,000 people in just a single day, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, notably absent from today's task force briefing, spoke yesterday about falling death rates.
It's a false narrative to take comfort in a lower rate of death. There's so many other things that are very dangerous and bad about this virus. Don't get yourself into false complacency.
Ohio is one of several states seeing an uptick in COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and positive COVID-19 test results. Dr. Tara Smith is an infectious disease epidemiologist at Kent State University in Ohio. So first, Dr. Smith, do you agree with Dr. Fauci?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. One of the things we are seeing with this virus is that it's not only about the mortality. We are seeing people that get infected with this and potentially have long-term, maybe chronic conditions that come from this, long-term problems with their lungs, with breathing, potentially with mental issues. We've seen reports of kind of brain fog, almost a chronic fatigue-like syndrome that seems to follow some of these people. And some people that have been dubbed long haulers that after months, they still don't seem to be getting well. And these are many people that are, you know, relatively young and healthy. So not the elderly, those with poor health that tend to make up more of those who are dying from this, but those who are otherwise really not at high risk of death from coronavirus, but are having these long-term complications. So I think we need to focus not only on mortality and on deaths from this, but really on the entire clinical picture.
Yeah, and also on prevention. You know, the one proven thing that people can do to limit the spread of COVID-19 is wear masks and, of course, socially distance. Your governor there in Ohio, Mike DeWine, is requiring masks now in the hardest hit counties. That starts later today. What's your sense of people taking that up?
Yeah, we've already seen a lot of resistance to that. In Ohio, we have a pretty active anti-vaccine group. And, of course, now they've kind of moved into the anti-COVID and anti-mask contingent. So I'm hoping that people will do the right thing and that most of them will use masks without objection when they're out in public to try to prevent spread of this, especially in those hard hit counties. But I know that there is already some resistance to this. And I think we're seeing that across the country as well, that people, you know, some small subset of people are just really reluctant to wear masks and refuse those and suggest it infringes on their civil liberties. But I think most of the people, I hope, will really take this up and protect their neighbors.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned the conflation of the anti-vaccine movement with the anti-masks movement. We've seen that. Speak to people directly. You know, speak to people who think that this is just something being imposed on them by Democrats, for instance. We've heard people say that. Speak to them directly.
Right. Well, that's kind of the irony is that a lot of the people who are resistant to this also would consider themselves, I think, conservative Christians. And of course, one of the key elements of Jesus's talks was love thy neighbor. And that's exactly what you're doing with by wearing a mask is, you know, you're protecting your neighbor, they're protecting you. And so I think really to protect your communities and to really show that you are pro-life, that masking should be the bare minimum thing that you do. And so I really don't understand why that is not getting out into that type of community.
Yeah. And one last thing. Talk to us about the evidence now that smaller droplets of the virus that are expelled just when people talk can linger in the air longer, kind of surf the air, as opposed to larger droplets from a cough that might fall. What should people know about that? I mean, I'm assuming one thing is don't be inside with groups as much as possible. But what else should people know?
Yeah, and I think that's something really that just reinforces what we've been saying the whole time is that indoor spread is most critical and most important and being in relatively close contact with people for an extended period of time. I don't think this is as easily airborne as something like measles that can linger for many hours and infect a larger number of people. But again, it's just really reinforces that necessity to try to stay away from individuals, just try to keep everything outdoors as much as possible. And when you are indoors, to wear those masks as much as you can to try to protect yourself from both large and small droplets.
Tara Smith, who's an infectious disease epidemiologist at Kent State University in Ohio. Dr. Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
And again, while in today's task force briefing at the Department of Education, Vice President Pence indicated the CDC would be issuing new guidelines on schools reopening, something the president is calling for, Dr. Deborah Birx cautioned that people in states where cases are spiking should not even go to restaurants or gather many people in their homes. And now to the forthcoming book by Mary Trump, President Trump's niece. The White House is denying the claims in the book, calling it a pack of lies. But Mary Trump is the daughter of Freddie Trump, the president's older brother. It's been pretty well documented elsewhere that Freddie was tormented by his father, Fred Sr., for not wanting to join the family business. Fred Jr. died of an alcohol-related heart attack when Mary Trump was just 16. As he was rushed to the hospital, she writes, Donald and his sister went to the movies. Their parents stayed home. Mary Trump is now a doctor of psychology, and she describes in grim detail the atmosphere of family psychological and emotional abuse she says shaped Donald Trump and made him what she calls the dysfunctional and dangerous man he is today. The book is Too Much and Never Enough, and our next guest says we should pay close attention because it fits with his 35 years of covering Donald Trump. David K. Johnston is a former New York Times investigative journalist, a specialist on tax policy, and author of two books about Donald Trump. And David, we know you just got your copy of this book. In skimming it, your thoughts?
Well, the book has many new and important elements to it, things that were either suspected but not provable by myself and others who have studied Donald closely for many years. It makes clear that the dysfunctional nature of this family, a family where there is no love, the currency is not affection, it is money, where there are no ethics. As long as you get money, you're a winner and the other people are a loser. And where Fred Trump was emotionally brutal to his sons, and Donald saw an opportunity when his older brother, the natural heir apparent, just could not live with Fred Trump's meanness, to step in and mold himself to become his father's servant in every way. So I think this is a very important book, rich with detail about how it is that Donald Trump grew up to be a sociopath, someone with no regard for anyone else, and, as I've called him many times, a stone-cold racist.
Well, there are those who say Mary Trump is just an aggrieved relative who didn't get as much of an inheritance as she wanted. Talk a little bit about what has been written about before. Did Donald Trump step in and interfere with the inheritance that would have gone from his father, Fred Sr., to her father, Fred Jr., and thus to her and her brother?
There's clear evidence of that before this book, and Mary Trump's book adds to this. When Fred Trump died, he was not mentally with it. And when the will was sent around to the beneficiaries, it turned out that Mary Trump and her brother, who are the niece and nephew of Donald Trump, had been cut out of the will. They discovered upon further inquiry that actually they were entitled to land rents underneath one of the big Trump apartment projects, and there was a scheme to try and cheat them out of that.
She was cut out of something that sounds like it was rightfully hers, and then writes again in the book about another time when, according to Mary Trump, Donald Trump cut off health care to Mary's brother's newborn son to leverage a settlement so that he could get more money from his father's estate at her expense. And he said back at the time, hey, they got a lot of money. I mean, it does go to the question, who cuts off your deceased brother's children from money that's rightfully theirs?
Well, this goes to the heart of who Donald Trump is. Mary Trump I think it's clear she's not happy about what happened with the will, but she's more concerned with the fact that Donald manipulated this in the way that is typical of his business deals to cheat his older brother's family out of any inheritance to benefit himself. And I think to attribute bad motives to her is not supported by the actual content of the book. The book has balance and insight. It is not a screed. It is a very thoughtful piece of work. And she is the first Trump family member to stand up and speak outside the family about these matters.
You have reported on how Donald Trump avoided paying taxes for years. Mary Trump was the person who provided financial records that formed the basis of the New York Times reporting on how much money Donald Trump really has. Do we learn anything more about Trump's taxes in this book as we await a Supreme Court decision on whether or not he has to reveal those documents?
Yes. In a non-technical way, she makes very clear that a number of devices were used by Fred Trump to evade gift taxes as he funneled money from his wealth to his four surviving children. If the Supreme Court rules that Donald Trump's business records have to be turned over to the New York grand jury, I'm sure we will get even further proof that the whole Trump family, including recently retired federal judge Marianne Trump Barry, are major league serial tax cheats at a level for which I've written about people who went to prison for it and died there.
David K. Johnston, do you think this book will matter? Because we've known much of this sordid family history for a while.
Well, that, Robin, is a really good question. There's a fair number of people who decided to go with Donald Trump because they were unhappy with the direction of the country. And I think that this book has the potential to move some of those people and open some eyes of people to things that they have avoided or tried to explain away or to rationalize.
David K. Johnston, co-founder of DCReport.org, a former New York Times journalist and author of two books about Donald Trump, The Making of Donald Trump, and It's Even Worse Than You Think, on Donald Trump's niece Mary Trump's new book. David K. Johnston, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to one of the unknowns of the coronavirus. Though many people who've been seriously ill from COVID-19 are older or have underlying health conditions, it's still unclear what causes others to get really sick. Aquarius Bunch was a healthy 27-year-old working at an assisted living facility in the Midwest when she fell severely ill from COVID-19, and she was pregnant. Side Effects Public Media's Natalie Krebs has her story.
When Aquarius Bunch tested positive for COVID-19, she quarantined alone at home, hoping to ride out her fever and cough.
I was taking several baths and showers a day. I was checking my temperature. I was drinking tea. I was staying hydrated.
But Bunch got sicker and wound up in the emergency room in Waterloo, a small city in eastern Iowa.
I really don't remember much. I just remember they were checking my temperature. They gave me some Tylenol and I thought I was getting ready to go home. That's what I remember.
Bunch's condition deteriorated fast. She had a seizure, and doctors decided she would need to be transferred to Iowa City, some 80 miles away.
And so they quickly contacted our team at the University of Iowa.
Sharon Beth Larson is a heart surgeon at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. She says there was something else to worry about.
To say we have a COVID-19 patient who has a periviable fetus. So this is a fetus at an age where it is not likely to survive outside the uterus.
Bunch was 6 months pregnant and her lungs were failing.
She was, at that point, not responsive. She was sedated. She was paralyzed. She was on the mechanical ventilator.
Larson was called in because Bunch needed more than that ventilator to survive. Her organs still weren't getting enough oxygen, so her only chance was a complex invasive life support procedure known as ECMO. Larson says ECMO is used on just 1-2% of the sickest COVID-19 patients. It involves surgically attaching tubes and monitors to pump oxygen into the blood. This would give Bunch's lungs a chance to heal.
And then we can wean the support and let the patient continue to recover.
But odds were against Bunch. Larson says when COVID-19 patients get to the point where they're placed on ECMO therapy, fewer than half survive. Plus, there was the issue of the pregnancy. Larson says patients on ECMO nearly always undergo emergency deliveries.
There's bleeding complications. There's thrombotic or blood clot complications. So we were doing the very best we could in this very rare and unique situation.
And Larson says during the hour that it took to do the procedure, the room was tense, filled with emotion. A team monitored the fetus, ready to deliver if necessary. But it wasn't, and Bunch made it through.
I remember waking up, and I was on Zoom with my family. They were waving at me, smiling, and, you know, talking to me. And I just thought I was in a dream.
Bunch and her lungs improved rapidly, so much so that a little over a week later, she was taken off of ECMO. The next day, her ventilator was removed. And just 2 weeks after Bunch arrived in Iowa City by air ambulance, she was sent home. At a follow-up appointment, she got to talk with Larson.
I felt very emotional because, you know, she saved my life. Like, it was just, I was so glad to be able to see her and express my feelings and emotions about how I felt.
And Larson says Bunch has been a source of inspiration during what she calls a dark and disturbing few months at the University Hospital battling COVID-19.
Maybe things will never be normal again in the hospital, but it just felt so good that we conquered this virus, that Aquarius conquered this virus that has taken out so many of our friends and family and loved ones and colleagues.
Aquarius Bunch is now at home in Waterloo. Her baby girl is due in August. For Here and Now, I'm Natalie Krebs.
United Airlines sent layoff warnings to more than a third of its staff today, 36,000 people, after announcing that the number of passengers booking future flights is starting to decline again as COVID-19 cases spike. The news came as United and four other airlines became the latest carriers to receive billions more in federal loans under the CARES Act. Here and Now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now with more on this. Seth, what more do we know, first of all, about these layoff notices, 36,000 employees?
Yeah, these are employees who could be laid off. When these big companies are planning to do a layoff, they have to warn anybody who might be impacted. So the final number could be somewhat less than that. These airlines all promised not to lay anybody off involuntarily, at least through the end of September, as a condition of taking all kinds of aid under the CARES Act. But come October 1st, well, that could be a very dark day in the industry. So up to 36,000 employees, even though perhaps some of them will be saved. Although I'll tell you, Jeremy, just in recent days, there are signs that, are, if anything, are more pessimistic.
And what about the passenger demand? United had said yesterday that August bookings were down, and so they were going to cut some capacity. What do we know about passenger demand right now for flying?
Well, that's the key, and that's what I was talking about. Jeremy, if you and I went out to a U.S. airport right now, we would see far fewer people traveling than we would have seen, let's say, a year ago. But on the other hand, we would see far more people traveling than a few months ago, even than a few weeks ago. And in fact, in recent days, new records, COVID-era records at least, record high numbers of passengers. That might seem like a good sign, but what we see isn't everything. Airlines have somewhat of a crystal ball. That's called future reservations, bookings. And that's the problem, as you said, United, for one, saying that with all these new cases of COVID in hotspots across the Sun Belt, especially, bookings have softened noticeably.
And what about federal relief? Billions of dollars have already been handed out to the airlines under the CARES Act. What are the details of these latest round of funding from Washington?
Yeah, there's about $50 billion in aid. This isn't new money. But about half of that $50 billion was in the form of what were mostly grants, mostly free money, you might say. Then the other half, loans that airlines could decide later whether or not to take. And there was speculation that maybe some of the relatively healthy airlines wouldn't take those loans. But sure enough, Jeremy, airlines like Delta and Southwest, which were in relatively decent shape going into the crisis, have joined others, 10 major airlines, saying that they are, in fact, going to take those loans.
Finally, Seth, people who are flying are often required to wear masks. I know you've got some new information about how that's going, that policy.
Yeah, airlines enforcing the policy more than before. There was a Spirit flight where a passenger got off rather than wear a mask. It was going to be from LaGuardia down to Fort Lauderdale Airport. Police had boarded when he refused, although it all sort of ended peacefully. On the other hand, a listener to the podcast I host, Call Airlines Confidential, wrote in, sent a picture of an airline pilot flying another airline who he refused to wear a mask. He told the pilot of that airline when he came back to ask him to wear it, according to this listener, that he had some sort of disability. But then after the pilot walked away, this listener said, he said, quote, "Life's dangerous, bro. People got to get over it."
Seth Kaplan here, now transportation analyst. Thank you.
Gail Caldwell, the former Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic for the Boston Globe, has been telling her own story for years now. In A Strong West Wind, she wrote about growing up in the 1950s Texas Panhandle. Let's Take the Long Way Home was about her deep friendship with fellow author Caroline Knapp, their shared sobriety, love of rowing, dogs, their guys, until cancer took Caroline way too young. Now, in the new Bright Precious Thing, we meet a 17-year-old Gail in 1968, feeling like she's been shot out of a cannon, only to be caught and cradled by the women's movement. And she was writing about this a few years ago in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when into her life walked a neighborhood girl, Tyler, who already had the hard-won assurance that Gail spent decades finding at the age of 5. And Gail Caldwell joins us now to talk about it. Gail, welcome.
Robin, thank you so much.
Well, I have to tell you, I hate you, because every time I think, oh, maybe I'll dabble in memoir, you write one, and I quit. Talk about 1968. As you write, ill-equipped for the sex, drugs, and rock and roll that defined that time, wary of the alternative, the path of marriage and motherhood that seemed equally lethal, at least for you. Now, some women would say they went from villager outfits with little circle pins at their necks to combat boots and pants in one day, not you.
Yeah, I think because I grew up in the panhandle, or because I was in blue jeans instead of villager pins. I was smoking cigarettes in the school parking lot. You know, I was like smart girl, bad girl. And that was the kind of the only revolution there was in the Texas panhandle. You know, it was the James Dean date the guy who's too old, drives a heap of a car, and you have to like sneak around the block to meet him. That made me primed for a revolution.
As you said, a wet bandana in your back pocket for tear gas because of the anti-war protests. And there you are, hitchhiking, liberating, but also petrifying. There's a guy who picks up you and a friend, drives you down a country road demanding something in return. I mean, talk about that combination of sky's the limit and I'm afraid.
Oh God, the danger of freedom, yeah. I mean, it's just amazing to me when I look back. I have a friend who's watching her daughters at the protests right now. And I said, oh, my God, I'm too old to be out there. I'd be like the guy who falls, you know. But I was fearless. I remember being fearless and angry and passionate. And I thought nothing could stop us, of course.
Well, when this was all happening, and then you came upon this North Star, you know, the women's movement. Mm-hmm. What did that mean to you?
You know, it's funny when you said that I have a vision of it. I think I was a young anti-war protester. The sexism within the anti-war movement. I remember a guy, a very well-meaning Vietnam vet who I became good friends with, said to me, "What's a chick like you doing at a place like this?" And so there was already a kind of demeaning, you know, make the coffee, but you can't really do much here because you have no idea what this is about. And then I remember I stumbled across a bunch of loud women talking at an outside rally. And I kind of stopped on the fringes to listen. And I loved the gutsiness of this woman. I was like, ah. And I remember looking over my shoulder like, ooh, are there boyfriends around? You know, like that first fear of like, can we do this? Will we get caught? Mm. And that was this very shy, careful turning point for me. The beginning of something, you know, it took somewhere profound, and then a lot of my life started to steer in that direction, and that would have been around 1970, 71, which is really when the women's movement started. And so it was on the heels of civil rights and Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I jumped on that wagon, and I don't look back and think, well, the next 50 years of my life were about activism. They weren't. What you said in your introduction was really so spot on, because that's what happened when I met Tyler, the five-year-old you describe. And I saw this amazing child who said things to me that it took me half my life to be able to embrace. And I was so blown away that here was our victory. Here was a five-year-old who said to me during the Summer Olympics, I can swim faster than Katie Ledecky. My eyes just teared up. I was like, oh, my God, it took me years of therapy to even begin to think I could do such a thing. And now we've created these generations of girls who think they can.
Can you think of other things? I'm paging through here.
She was right out of Central Casting, I can tell you. And I think the one that really slayed me was when I was washing dishes one day, and she must have been five. And we had never talked about the fact that I lived alone, or was there anybody special in my life. Or I was washing dishes, and she was lying on the floor with the dog, and she said, so, did you vow never to marry? I tried not to burst out laughing, because who says that? It's like Jane Eyre, you know? I don't know where she even got the word, you know? I remember saying to her, I've loved a lot of people, and I've spread my love around. And she absolutely took it as the way the world worked.
Yeah. So, Gail, a lot of what this book is also about, mm-hmm, is, yep, as you say, not choosing the traditional route. It just wasn't for you. But how much love is in your life? You also lose love, whether it's this extraordinary friend, Caroline, everybody was jealous of you too, mm-hmm, or dogs, that willingness to put yourself out for that possible loss and therefore create this family under your own direction.
Oh, thank you for saying that and for seeing it that way. Sometimes on dark winter nights where I think, oh, God, why didn't I just do it the other way, where I'm surrounded by, you know, kids and husbands or wives and partners and all kinds of relationships, so I wouldn't have to face that sort of lonely sound. Though there is, I will say, always a dog in my house, at least one. I think it's a hard way to go, and I also think it was the way that was set for me for a long time. You know, you make room for those concentric circles of intimacy, and I think even with Tyler, my front door was open to her in every sense of the word. You know, that I was this writer who lived alone, and people sort of knew, you know, don't bother me between this hour and that. Tyler had no rules, and it was like she would open the front door and go, I'm back. And she knew that I made room for that girl in my heart from day one. Yeah.
I was just wondering, though, is it like Peter Pan? You know, has she, in ways that you have to let her, moved on?
Oh, you have to. You have to, and that's the thing. I think I said I've done my job of being a good memory in the making. I think I said in the book, she has taught me far more than I have her. Mm-hmm. And she poked me in the ribs and said, doubtful. This is what you're supposed to do, is make them let go of you.
When it came to this little girl and parts of your book, there's a callous rape, not that any rape isn't, but college kid. There's, mm-hmm, you know, the bosses who say, I'll give you this if you give me a little of that. I mean, mm-hmm, awful stuff. Did you feel the need to tell her about that?
You mean warn her? Not so much. And the reason is what I said at the beginning. She moves with an alacrity that I never had at that age. The notion that anybody could mess with her. Now, I did warn her, and I'd say, honey, if you ever, ever decide that you're going to try drugs or alcohol, or you get in a situation that's dangerous, you have to promise, because, you know, I know kids aren't going to call their moms. I said, call me. Just you promise that you will talk to me. And she said, Gail, I'm not going to do any of that. And then looked at me like I was a real idiot and said, I'm already awesome. And I thought, my work here is done, or somebody's work here is done. I don't know. I look back and I think the conversation that I got from my very Presbyterian, be careful, you know, that the whole code of honor, it didn't protect me, sadly, at all. Sometimes I put myself in danger, but sometimes all the good intentions and honor in the world was not going to keep you from a bad guy.
Yeah. Well, circle pins weren't a protection either, even though they weren't there at your neck like a lock.
That's right. Though, you know, I do know somebody who said her mother taught her how to use a hat pin. And she never forgot it. So there was that.
Gail Caldwell, her latest memoir is Bright, Precious Thing. Gail, thank you so much.
It's wonderful to talk to you, Robin. Thank you.
There are less than 4 months until the election, so let's turn to Montana for this week's Senate Tracker, our look at Senate races across the country. Incumbent Republican Senator Steve Daines is facing a challenge there from Montana's governor, former presidential candidate, Democrat Steve Bullock. Eric Whitney is NPR Bureau Chief for the Rocky Mountains and Great Plains, and he joins us from Missoula, Montana. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with Senator Daines, who has held this seat since 2015. He recently spoke on Fox News about the historical statues, many Confederate figures being spray painted or toppled by protesters. Let's listen.
We've got to stand up against this mob rule. That's what's going on. We've got to stop the mob. And the mob does not stand for the vast majority of men and women in this country who love our country, who want to see law and order, who want to see peaceful protest.
Sounds like he's aligning himself pretty closely there with President Trump's view on the subject. What has the senator's record been like, and how is he positioning himself in this race?
He's very much embracing President Trump in this race, and has since, you know, shortly after the president got elected. He originally endorsed Marco Rubio in the 2016 election, but once the president was elected, he quickly got on board and has allied himself really closely with President Trump, which I think is a smart strategy for somebody trying to get elected in Montana.
Montana is a state that President Trump won by 20 points. How does he factor into this race? And is he losing any support, at least as far as you can tell, in Montana?
You know, there's not a lot of polling in Montana, and there's no hard evidence that the president is losing ground. A couple of longtime election watchers here in Montana that I've spoken to say it's plausible that the president might be losing some support over handling of the coronavirus and the racial justice events that have been happening. You know, there's no hard evidence of that, but, you know, the president could lose a substantial amount of support here and still win. To the degree that he does lose support, that's going to make it harder for Senator Daines to get reelected.
And worth pointing out, by the way, that coronavirus is spiking big time in Montana right now, right?
Yeah, relatively. I mean, the percentage increase in cases is a lot larger than it was in the past. But, you know, yesterday we had a record number of cases, which is significant. On the other hand, it's 80 cases. So it's not huge numbers. And I wouldn't say it's out of control here, but it is definitely concerning and rising at a very rapid rate.
All right, let's talk about Senator Daines' opponent, Montana Governor Steve Bullock. We remember that he ran for president and then dropped out of the race on the Democratic side. He recently posted this video online asking people to wear masks.
The virus is still with us, and we must act like it. We need to promote respect and kindness toward others. That's part of what it means to be a Montana. Wearing a mask is a necessary act of solidarity to look out for one another.
Now, Governor Bullock has obviously been able to win statewide in Montana before. How has he been positioning himself in this race, and what has his record as governor been like?
I think he's positioned himself, you know, in this race and throughout his tenure, his two terms here, as, you know, a steady, moderate hand. And that's very much the position he's taking in his campaign ads and messaging at this point is, you know, if you look at Washington, you see chaos and partisanship and extreme views, and you need to elect somebody who's from outside of Washington, who's a steady hand and is proven to work across the aisle, as he's done here, you know, significantly. He worked with Republicans to expand Medicaid in the state. So he's saying, you know, I'm the steady moderate hand that will go to Washington and bring down the chaos level there.
Now, you say there are not a lot of polls regarding President Trump. Do we have any polls yet on this Senate race?
There have been a few. The last one that I think is really credible happened in April out of Montana State University. And it had the race within the margin of error, you know, both candidates polling around 45, 47%. So very much a toss-up. And I haven't seen any evidence to push it one way or the other. I think, you know, if another poll was held today, it would still be within the margin of error or very close.
Very difficult to try to predict the future about what's going to happen in the coming months because of the coronavirus. But would you be surprised if President Trump or Joe Biden made a visit to the state of Montana during this race?
We haven't heard anything about a Biden visit. And I don't know that a Biden visit would necessarily be welcomed by the Bullitt campaign. I don't know that they're necessarily that Joe Biden is going to be a person that he's going to want to be seen campaigning with, especially if Republicans paint Joe Biden as a far left liberal. I think Steve Bullock would prefer to campaign on his own merits at this point. President Trump has said that he's going to come to Montana to campaign for Senator Daines. Last time he came to Montana in the last election cycle, he came four times to campaign on behalf of the Republican Senate candidate. That candidate lost, and our other senator, Democrat John Tester, was reelected by a larger margin than he has before. So it remains up in the air whether a Trump visit is really going to help Senator Daines or not. I think a lot of that's going to have to do with how the country feels about how the president is handling the coronavirus situation.
That is Eric Whitney, NPR bureau chief for the Rocky Mountains and Great Plains, joining us from Missoula, Montana. Eric, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Robin, it's going to be a very strange campaign season. Who knows if there'll be any campaigning at all, right, in person. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WVUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.